today on Against the Grain. It's billed as a community-driven, less coercive anti-terrorism initiative. But according to Nicole Wynn, the U.S. government's Countering Violent Extremism program criminalizes Muslim youth and transforms school teachers and others into terrorist watchdogs. I'm C.S. The University of Illinois Chicago professor talks about her book, Suspect Communities, Anti-Muslim Racism and the Domestic War on Terror, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. It's called Countering Violent Extremism, or CVE. It's a U.S. government program, a set of initiatives aimed at combating homegrown terrorism. CVE purportedly does this by enlisting Muslim community leaders and service providers in the U.S. to monitor and report on young people considered vulnerable to terrorist radicalization. But according to Nicole Wynn, CVE turns teachers, mental health professionals, religious leaders, and others into terrorism watchdogs. These people take on policing functions in support of a project that criminalizes Muslim youth. Nicole Wynn is Associate Professor of Social Foundations of Education at the University of Illinois at Chicago. Her most recent book, about the nature and impact of the Countering Violent Extremism program, is entitled Suspect Communities, Anti-Muslim Racism and the Domestic War on Terror. At our behest, Nicole Wynn prepared a talk about a portion of her book. Then I interviewed her about a number of related issues. When I connected with Nicole recently, she began this way.
Many of you may remember that in September 2015, ninth grade student Ahmed Mohammed brought a homemade clock to his public high school. As a robotics enthusiast, Ahmed intended to show his engineering teacher his latest invention. Before he had the chance, however, Ahmed's teacher confiscated the clock and reported him to school administration. Believing the clock was a hoax bomb, the police arrested Ahmed and transported him to a juvenile detention facility for fingerprinting and additional questioning. And Ahmed's story illustrates how anti-Muslim racism affixes the terrorist label to students perceived to be Muslim. Governing national security policies and discourses infused with anti-Muslim racism shaped how school staff responded to Ahmed as a potential terrorist. Ahmed's experience fits into broader national security fears, anxieties, and practices that position youth, especially Muslim youth, as budding terrorists. The FBI, for example, warns that, quote, high school students are ideal targets for recruitment by violent extremists. Given this framing of students, the FBI cautions that high schools must remain vigilant in educating their students about catalysts that drive violent extremism and the potential consequences of embracing extremist beliefs. Moreover, the FBI calls on teachers, guidance counselors, and other social service providers to, quote, observe and assess concerning behaviors and communications indicative of students embracing extremist ideologies and progressing on a trajectory toward violence. Just a few months before Ahmed's arrest, President Obama convened a global summit where he formally introduced a new Countering Violent Extremism, or CVE, initiative. Increasingly concerned about homegrown terrorists, the Obama administration promoted CVE as a new national security strategy to deter young people from joining violent extremist groups like ISIS without abrogating their constitutional rights. So in this new national security model, community members act as key national security operatives who counter terrorist propaganda, as well as identify, report, and work with individuals perceived to be vulnerable to or in the process of terrorist radicalization. The CVE model has mobilized community members and social service providers like Ahmed's teachers as co-producers of national security. Working from the premise that Muslim youth are uniquely susceptible to terrorist radicalization, CVE actors have argued that this co-production of national security offers a progressive alternative to more conventional counterterrorism methods like FBI stings, preemptive prosecutions, and blanket surveillance by increasing community participation in the domestic war on terror, amplifying the voices of Muslim Americans, and improving community police relations. So in the United States, CB initiatives intend to most broadly counter online extremist propaganda, identify individuals vulnerable to terrorist radicalization, disrupt this radicalization process, and finally prevent or build resilience to violent extremism through the provision of social services. Now, countering violent extremism programs generally treat terrorism, or more accurately, political violence, as rooted in certain psychological, theological, or cultural pathologies or perversions, rather than a serious political orientation, such as a desire to depose Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. Now, this national security approach has involved what folks refer to as either prevention or intervention lines of effort. In the CVE policy environment, prevention refers to the proactive measures that seek to stop radicalization before it begins. And these proactive community-wide measures have included counter-messaging campaigns to thwart terrorist propaganda on social media, after-school activities like youth soccer leagues to reduce feelings of disaffection and alienation believed to drive the radicalization process, and family programs designed to increase parental involvement and supportive adult mentorship for youth. So these preemptive programs have worked to prevent youth from radicalizing and also has sort of developed community police partnerships in the process. To support this mission, the FBI developed an online learning module called Don't Be a Puppet, Pull Back the Curtain on Violent Extremism, which works to keep young people from embracing violent extremist ideologies. So through Don't Be a Puppet, young people learn to define violent extremism, recognize extremist propaganda, and identify where to get help if they know someone, quote unquote, in trouble. Don't Be a Puppet also encourages adults to report children to authorities if they, quote, spend a lot of time reading violent extremist information online, talk about traveling to places that sound suspicious, or use private messaging apps, as such warning signs, quote, could mean that someone plans to commit violence. Although intended to be a high school requirement, Don't Be a Puppet received significant backlash from civil rights organizations, from Muslim advocacy groups, and from the American Federation of Teachers, all of whom argued that Don't Be a Puppet risked chilling political discussions in the classroom and dehumanizing Muslim students by conflating difference and dissent with violence. More generally, critics also worry that managing curriculum, monitoring internet searches, and identifying potential youth terrorists in and through schools inevitably introduce ethical, practical, and political questions related to ideological policing, freedom of expression, and open access to information. In this view, efforts like Don't Be a Puppet have sought to prevent terrorist radicalization before extreme ideas take root, but often treat Muslim children as uniquely susceptible to terrorist violence, which results in the disproportionate monitoring of Muslim children in their classrooms. Furthermore, initiatives like Don't Be a Puppet assume that radical ideas drive violence, even though no research has demonstrated a connection between the two. In fact, most people who hold radical ideas never commit an act of violence, and many who do enact such violence are not deeply ideological. Today, Don't Be a Puppet still exists for home and classroom use, but it's not a high school requirement as initially intended. So Don't Be a Puppet and these other initiatives are what CVE practitioners refer to as prevention programs. On the other side, there are these more popular intervention efforts that have focused on identifying individuals in the process of terrorist radicalization and then providing interventions that interrupt this process. Security professionals, for example, have encouraged communities to develop what's known as crisis inquiry teams or multidisciplinary teams to reach quote-unquote troubled individuals. Composed of social workers, mental health professionals, teachers, police officers, and religious leaders, these teams or committees first identify individuals who appear to be vulnerable to or in the process of terrorist radicalization. And to identify these individuals, the teams across the country have used indicators or warning signs or risk factors that social scientists have discredited, but they include things like expressing outrage over U.S. foreign policy, having an interest in adventure and action, or wearing traditional Islamic clothing. So after identifying vulnerable individuals, these teams then conduct interventions, like mental health treatment, to off-ramp individuals from the perceived pathway to violent extremism. So these teams intervene in the lives of young people when they exhibit the perceived warning signs of terrorist radicalization. In Maryland, for example, CVE-trained school resource officers identified Arab students experiencing homesickness, acculturation-related stress, and economic stressors, all of which allegedly suggest that they might be at risk of violent extremism. So applying a CVE lens to their communities, school personnel and other social service providers have come to interpret common immigrant experiences and other teenage struggles as signs of terrorist radicalization, requiring interventions facilitated by community police partnerships. In Minnesota, Minneapolis Public Schools plan to hire youth intervention workers to, quote, spot identity issues and disaffection believed to be the root causes of violent extremism. A recent high school graduate reported that CVE adds to the barriers we're already facing as Black Muslim men by criminalizing their political ideologies, cultural orientation, and everyday behaviors while in school. In his words, CVE practitioners, quote, know nothing about us, and they want to come to our school and tell us how to walk and talk and what to do. America wants you to act a certain way, and if you don't, they're not having it. In fact, a Somali elder developed YouTube videos to teach Somali youth to, quote, walk in both worlds, meaning the traditions of Islam and the culture of the New World, an approach that unfortunately reinforces this fundamental clash between cultural systems. One college student described these YouTube videos as, quote, utter garbage, premised on what she referred to as the creator's own internalized colonialism and racialized tropes that position Muslims as always already on the verge of terrorist violence. A community organizer similarly explained to me that, quote, as a Muslim American, CVE makes me feel criminalized. It makes me feel like because of my religious identity, I will be viewed through a lens of national security. It makes me feel like I'm viewed as a potential terrorist first, a counterterrorism tool second, and an everyday normal American citizen entitled to their constitutional freedoms last. Recognizing they lived in disinvested communities, Muslim youth appreciated access to community resources like youth soccer leagues and increased supports in school. Yet they also rejected CVE's premise that they deserve these services as ticking time bombs, rather than as deserving members of society, and actually argue that these services needed to be independent of the security state, of the provision of security regimes and surveillance.
That's Nicole Wynn talking about her book, Suspect Communities, Anti-Muslim Racism and the Domestic War on Terror. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Nicole teaches at the University of Illinois at Chicago. CVE is short for the U.S. government's Countering Violent Extremism Program. We go back now to more of Nicole's talk.
So through the recasting of community spaces like schools as critical national security sites to thwart the so-called generational threat, Muslim youth continue to come of age under constant surveillance, a type of monitoring increasingly undertaken and supported by their own elders, teachers, and therapists, in addition to law enforcement. Despite these ongoing critiques, CVE actors also have developed a portfolio of educational programs to buffer Muslim youth from the perceived push and pull factors that could draw them closer to violent extremism. As a part of this educational portfolio, CVE actors established global citizenship education programs to combat terrorism. Local practitioners in the United States have argued that global citizenship education can, quote, socially engineer a more integrated identity, like the global citizen, resilient to violent extremism. For example, in a CVE training for college staff, one practitioner defined global citizenship education as a quote-unquote human security approach and a defensive measure organized around what sociologists refer to as cosmopolitan theory. So this scholarship argues that given the presence of global risks like economic crises and terrorist attacks, the imagined community of the global or the cosmopolitan, rather than the national, is central to survival. So global citizenship education could contribute to the development of cosmopolitan solutions to the perceived global yet intimately local problem of violent extremism. So this practitioner argued that a global citizen mindset, quote, surpasses national identities, surpasses any of these smaller pieces of identities, and so global citizenship education must induce a transformative process in students. In this view, this, quote, cognitive, behavioral, and emotional development of young people as global citizens effectively prevented violent extremism by rebuilding individual and group resilience in the process. By fostering the so-called integrated identity of the global citizen, these education programs arguably created more flexible spaces of belonging and counteracted identity-based groups like Muslim student associations perceived to threaten national security. So this approach views the accommodation of cultural differences and the drive for pluralism as contributing to social division and therefore incompatible with social cohesion. So the cultivation of cultural identities through educational venues like Muslim student associations allegedly generates deep cultural divides between students, thereby eliminating the possibility of developing a sense of common humanity and cross-cultural solidarity useful for fighting homegrown terrorism and fostering peace. As a CVE tool, global citizenship education programs have encouraged young people to subordinate their racial, religious, and cultural differences to an identification with the global. CVE actors have argued that this transformative process militates against social exclusion, alienation, and bullying that could facilitate the turn to violent extremism. Of course, these approaches also stigmatize cultural organizations like Muslim student associations developed in response to ongoing cultural erasure and state-sponsored and vigilante violence, and again, treat cultural differences as drivers of violence. In Maryland, for example, the World Organization for Resource Development and Education created its own Global Citizen Forum with the intention of cultivating Muslim children as global citizens to militate against the lure of violent extremism. To do so, this forum trained Muslim students, quote, on recognizing and assisting peers who might be experiencing isolation, personal crisis, or bullying. So by teaching Muslim students to recognize and use the early warning signs of distress or crisis, the Global Citizen Forum worked to empower youth to, quote, assist vulnerable individuals in seeking support services, thereby developing their global leadership skills, like cross-cultural communication, peer intervention, and conflict resolution in ways that could effectively counter violent extremism in their communities. So as a peer gatekeeper program designed to improve youth's help-seeking behaviors to overcome challenges they might experience in their lives, the Global Citizen Forum approached Muslim youth as susceptible to quote-unquote destructive and violent behaviors and therefore in need of positive youth development programming. So the forum approached peer intervention, meaning the identification and reporting of vulnerable individuals as an inarguable feature of global citizenship. So these examples show us how global citizenship education initiatives applied to anti-terrorism agendas risk imposing a curricular framework that can denigrate difference, erase local knowledges, encourage youth to report struggling peers to law enforcement on the premise that they might be budding terrorists, and require youth to subordinate their cultural, religious, and racial differences, considered a security threat, to an identification with the global. So although global citizenship education certainly can nurture youth as social actors with a shared sense of global rights, responsibilities, and social justice, when placed in a CVE context, it can also impose a Western-centric schooling that erases and denigrates local cultures and knowledges and approach cultural, religious, and racial differences as threats to social cohesion and therefore potential drivers of violence. To enhance both local and global security, communities must work to eliminate these forms of difference and encourage children to report peers who appear vulnerable to terrorist influences. So targeted youth themselves define CVE programs in their schools and communities as a type of violence aimed at Muslim erasure. For example, community organizer Bashir rejected educational initiatives that contributed to cultural genocide, asking, quote, "How can I assimilate into a racist culture?" Bashir described his experiences with CVE as like looking down the barrel of a gun. A Somali college student credited CVE's popularity with the strategic advancement of what she called a colonial discourse that suggests that CVE can civilize the savage, and that Somali youth in return should gratefully say, quote, "Thank you for bringing us to America and civilizing us and putting pants on us." Rather than venerate whiteness, this student encouraged her peers to recognize that they were fully human by rejecting CVE and its organizing logics that position Muslim youth as ticking time bombs, only deserving of social services to enhance national security. So taking our cue from these community organizers, the U.S. public must take seriously how the state mobilizes schools and schooling to achieve its domestic war on terror agenda, ultimately criminalizing Muslim youth and deputizing teachers as terrorist watchdogs. Another Somali college student argued that, quote, "CVE is done in the furtherance of the American project, which is violence." In this view, countering violent extremism initiatives contributed to the expansion of U.S. empire, particularly by refusing to take terrorism seriously as a political project, while re-articulating a domestic threat reflective of its foreign enemies. And this refusal directly connects to one of the most common questions communities, practitioners, and security professionals raise. If not CVE, then what do we do about the problem of homegrown terrorism?
That's the voice of Nicole Nguyen. Her last name is spelled Nguyen. She's an associate professor of Social Foundations of Education at the University of Illinois at Chicago. We've put a link to Nicole's book, Suspect Communities, on our website, againstthegrain.org. You are listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. We left off with Nicole posing the question asked by authorities, if not CVE, if this federal program called Countering Violent Extremism didn't exist or wasn't implemented, what would we do about the problem of homegrown terrorism?
So to explore this question, I first want to just briefly begin with the academic studies, specifically radicalization research, that has informed the development of CVE programs and narrowed how we as a public have come to understand terrorism. So as folks may know, the term radicalization generally refers to the perceived process by which an ordinary person transforms into an ideologically driven violent actor. Researchers have sought to map this process and determine the possible signs that could be used to identify radicalizing individuals in what's known as left of boom, before they commit an act of terrorism. In doing so, these scholars have sought to understand why only a few individuals turn to such violence, if many believe seemingly with equal intensity and commitment in their cause. And these scholars often contemplate the cultural, psychological, and theological dispositions that might facilitate this turn to violence. So over the years, academic scholars and law enforcement agencies published reports that sought to map the radicalization process and identify effective methods to disrupt it. The New York City Police Department, for example, published an influential report called Radicalization in the West, the Homegrown Threat. This report outlined a four-stage radicalization process defined by a changing relationship with Salafi Islam, so immediately narrowing its focus on Muslim communities. Although social scientists have discredited the report's methodology and therefore its findings, the NYPD has argued that the consistency in behaviors and the trajectory of terrorism cases it studied provided a tool for predictability. Police officers on their beats could go out and look for certain behaviors to identify a radicalizing person. And the report outlined behaviors or warning signs like growing a beard,
giving up cigarettes and drinking, wearing traditional Islamic clothing, affiliating with like-minded individuals, becoming involved in social activism and community issues, and participating in outward-bound activities like camping, whitewater rafting, paintball games, and target shooting. Additional studies similarly listed more coded behaviors like outrage over U.S. foreign policy, economic stress, expressions of hopelessness and futility, concerns about anti-Muslim discrimination, and internal identity crises as other signs community members and police officers could use to identify individuals vulnerable to terrorist radicalization. So even as terrorism scholars admit that attempts to profile terrorists have failed resoundingly and conceded that these studies lack methodological rigor, anti-terrorism programs like CVE continue to rely on this research. And this research importantly reduces political violence to individuals' perceived cultural, psychological, and theological pathologies, ultimately ignoring the broader social, geopolitical, and economic conditions that give rise to political violence and erasing the political demands of violent actors. So the concept of radicalization continues to define our sort of common sense understandings of homegrown terrorism that ultimately absolves U.S. foreign policy in the rise of non-state violence. So essentially, radicalization research tells us to look at individual people and their own dispositions rather than think more broadly about the role of U.S. foreign policy in the making of political violence. And it's also important to note that these warning signs are explicitly racialized, imbuing innocuous religious conduct, such as praying five times a day and wearing traditional Islamic clothing, with predictive meaning. Such activities reliably indicate progression in or vulnerability to the radicalization process, ignoring the millions of Muslims who engage such practices without ever turning to violence. And such risk factors define terrorism as a Muslim problem. Other warning signs, such as feelings of hopelessness or economic stressors, are so broad that they only arouse suspicion when exhibited by Muslim, Arab, South Asian, and other communities of color. And the reporting of Black people for innocuous behaviors like bird watching should give us pause about programs that ask community members to take on such policing functions. So, unfortunately, radicalization research abstracts political violence from its formative contexts, erasing the geopolitical conditions like U.S. foreign policy that enable us to understand terrorism as more than an expression of cultural, psychological, and theological pathologies. Young Somali men who considered traveling to Syria to join oppositional forces seeking to depose President Bashar al-Assad, for example, have been treated as teenagers duped by terrorists lurking on social media, as fanatics driven by religious commandment, or as lost boys seeking adventure, friends, or a sense of purpose, rather than as political actors. Anthropologist Daryl Lee argues that despite the prominence of radicalization research, scholars would never write a cogent analysis of the U.S. invasion of Iraq by focusing on why soldiers volunteer to join the U.S. military, even as we pursue these individualizing questions with non-state actors. Yet it is by abstracting political violence from its formative conditions that CVE practitioners and communities have come to view educational initiatives, sports leagues, mental health counseling, religious training, and community surveillance as solutions to the problem of homegrown terrorism by fixing or preventing these individual pathologies and the threats to national security they allegedly pose, both criminalizing entire Muslim communities and ultimately misunderstanding political violence in the process. So our collective failure to engage more thoughtful analyses of political violence means that we'll continue to invest in and justify anti-terrorism initiatives that disproportionately target Muslim communities and reinforce normative assumptions that individual pathologies, radical ideas, and religious beliefs drive violence. In doing so, we authorize liberal reforms to domestic security regimes, viewing community-driven anti-terrorism initiatives as less coercive and more democratic, while expanding the policing of Muslim communities into the intimate spaces of daily life, like therapists' offices, school lunchrooms, and libraries. So for me, the answer isn't widening CPE's aperture to include violent white supremacists or to create better lists of warning signs, as the hunt for individual actors simply reasserts a racialized narrative that intensifies anti-Muslim policing, targeting Muslim bodies, psyches, and spaces, and fundamentally misunderstands political violence. So answering the question about what to do about homegrown terrorists requires shifting how we understand political violence in the first place. And so for me, the case of CVE demonstrates how struggles to make US security regimes more liberal, meaning participatory, community-led, and democratic by mobilizing communities and social service providers actually have enhanced the criminalization of Muslim communities while appearing to rein in past practices of racial profiling, constant surveillance, and political exclusion. For example, by calling on mental health professionals, school teachers, and other social service providers to identify, report, and work with individuals perceived to be vulnerable to or in the process of terrorist radicalization, CVE further transforms these helping professionals into terrorist watchdogs who take on the functions of the police through their daily interactions with their clients. CVE programs thus can undermine the trusting and confidential relationships social service providers require to serve their clients, thereby enhancing policing and prisons through the provision of these resources. So through CVE, youth soccer leagues, therapists' offices, schools, and other community spaces have transformed into key sites of national security, demonstrating how calls to defund the police cannot simply result in the funding of other state institutions similarly dedicated to policing communities of color. And lastly, the case of CVE demonstrates that Ahmed and his clock represent a typical, not exceptional, Muslim American experience in the domestic war on terror.
Nicole Wynn is her name. She was speaking about her book, Suspect Communities, Anti-Muslim Racism and the Domestic War on Terror. It's published by the University of Minnesota Press. We'll take a short break and then present a follow-up interview I did with Nicole. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. You heard University of Illinois at Chicago professor Nicole Wynn talking about her book, Suspect Communities, Anti-Muslim Racism and the Domestic War on Terror. We now bring you an interview I conducted with Nicole about some of the other issues raised in her book. So to what extent have these initiatives, these Countering Violent Extremism or CVE initiatives, been taken up by schools and communities? Can you give us a sense of the number of schools, for example, that have incorporated CVE into their curricula?
So I don't have an exact number for you, exact number of schools that have adopted CVE. And the reason for that is actually, in my view, a pretty positive one, and that's that CVE has been so hotly contested by communities and by teachers that the initial plans to unroll CVE across the country really has been more of sort of a hodgepodge mixture of successes and failures. So for example, Chicago Public Schools was a potential site for CVE, but that never came to fruition. So I think that's really the story of CVE across the country, is that there was initial energy to unfold this program, and it was met with a lot of community resistance, and the initial plans kind of fell through. And so political leaders and law enforcement agencies have really struggled to gain legitimacy and access within communities to roll out their plans.
So you mentioned in your talk about how countering violent extremism programs and initiatives, how they specifically target Muslim communities in the U.S. If that is so, and you know, you mentioned a lot of community members and young people talking about the effect, the negative effect that these programs, these initiatives have on them and their friends and family members, why do local Muslim leaders, or some of them, sign on to these programs?
Many community leaders lived through some of the earlier iterations of the domestic war on terror, for example, infiltrating mosques, conducting this sort of undercover blanket surveillance of Muslim communities. So many community leaders viewed CVE as what many folks refer to as having a seat at the table. And the idea was that with community input and community oversight, the previous era of blanket surveillance could be reined in and controlled better. So there was this common thread that I heard throughout my time doing this research, and that was, it's better to be at the table than on the menu. And so I think many leaders understood the limitations and the problems of CVE, but also worried that if they didn't contribute to these initiatives, that it would lead to the widening of past practices that they were desperately trying to disrupt through this process. So many saw their participation in CVE as a way to protect civil liberties and civil rights within their communities, even as other folks said, this is a continuation of the same logics, the same practices, the same programs. It just looks like it's more liberal, more democratic, and more participatory.
You attended a number of community meetings at which countering violent extremism practitioners presented their ideas and defended the program. Did they point to any specific success stories as evidence that CVE has worked, that it has been effective in identifying people who have radicalized in a violent direction or are vulnerable to such radicalization?
Sure. So I heard a presentation by one practitioner who said, you know, look, I got this referral from an FBI agent who is concerned about somebody who might be recruited by Al-Shabaab. This was a high school student who apparently showed signs that he was considering joining Al-Shabaab. And working with the FBI, a community organization in the school district, they effectively deterred him from joining Al-Shabaab and also were working with him to ensure that he graduated from high school. So this was seen as a success story that this person wanted to institutionalize through the implementation of CVE programs across the city. Now, these are seen as success stories, but it's really hard to say, sure, this person was going to be a terrorist and you intervened and deterred them from becoming a terrorist, versus this is a kid who's struggling with school and just needs some support, not because he's a future terrorist, but because he's a kid and, like other kids, needs extra supports to be successful in school. So I think what's difficult for CVE practitioners is that they're saying we're preventing all of these terrorist attacks from happening, we're preventing all of these kids from becoming violent extremists, but there's no way of knowing that that's what they're actually doing, or if they're actually just creating this problem by saying there are these telltale signs of someone who's vulnerable to becoming a terrorist, and we can identify them all, and then therefore say we're successful. When in a lot of these instances, as in the case of Maryland, what kids are exhibiting are just common immigrant experiences. They miss home. They are having a hard time adjusting to a new life. And those are not signs of becoming a terrorist. Those are signs of being a kid in the United States. So I think practitioners really struggled with showing that what they were doing was effective, because most people didn't really believe that they were deterring young people from becoming terrorists because they didn't really see young people who were interested in engaging political violence. And then I think the other thing was that practitioners really wanted to show that they weren't working with law enforcement to implement these CVE programs, but at the same time were also showing how they were collaborating with the FBI and other law enforcement agencies to enact these programs. So again, practitioners kind of wanted it all at the same time. They wanted to say that they weren't collaborating with law enforcement when in fact they were. They wanted to say that they were deterring violent extremists, but not actually having a viable way to prove that that's what they were doing. They wanted to use radicalization research while also showing that radicalization research was flawed, right? So they tried to hold all of these contradictions together in their daily work.
So if you have young people telling you that this isn't working, that they find these countering violent extremism initiatives offensive and dangerous and unwelcome in their communities, and yet you have, or they have, elders, they have teachers, they have therapists who are on board with the program and who may even admit to collaborating with law enforcement or at least implementing the CVE program, hasn't that created kind of intra-community tensions? Hasn't that divided some of the communities that you've had access to?
Absolutely. And this was part of the intention of the CVE program, was to sow discord within communities, to sow distrust and suspicion, and to really fracture Muslim communities across the country. And, you know, one organizer told me, look, the idea is to create this internal destruction, that the Muslim community essentially destroys itself through CVE, that this is the main agenda of the United States federal government, is to create this discord that essentially disrupts all of the resistance that's been mounting against these anti-terrorism initiatives since the onset of the global war on terror. So the idea was to create this internal destruction, this internal discord. And at the same time, community organizers understood that. And so they were trying to be strategic about how to contest CVE in a way that didn't sort of fuel the flames of that internal discord of fracturing the Muslim community and focusing their attention on going after, for example, the Department of Homeland Security and its federal funding of CVE. So, you know, it was sort of twofold, that the federal government intended in some ways to fracture the Muslim community and also Muslim communities understanding this intentionality behind CVE and really trying to challenge CVE without also then challenging their own elders and religious leaders in the process.
Nicole Wynn joins me. She teaches at the University of Illinois at Chicago, and her latest book is Suspect Communities: Anti-Muslim Racism and the Domestic War on Terror. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain. For those community organizations and schools that do sign on in some way to the CVE program, how much of that do you think is a fear of consequences, that they worry that if they don't get on board, they'll be seen as disloyal or as disruptive or potentially hiding or harboring folks who are prone to radicalization or who are being radicalized?
I think it's a mixture of different things, and different practitioners and social service providers had different viewpoints. Certainly, Muslim leaders worry that they'll be seen as protecting or hiding a terrorist in their mosque or their community. This is a narrative that has been well established by the US government, that Muslim communities are hiding potential terrorists. So there's certainly that sort of pressure to participate, to avoid that label, right? This good Muslim, bad Muslim narrative that really fractures communities. I also think that a lot of community leaders felt that there are young people who are radicalizing. And, you know, one person said, look, a lot of anti-CVE people are what he called ostriches. They plant their heads deep in the ground. They ignore the reality that there are young people who want to join ISIS. So, you know, for that group of people, they really saw a problem, and they saw collaborating with law enforcement, collaborating with social service providers as a way to address this reality that young people were radicalizing. I think other people were afraid that if we don't participate in this, the government's going to create some kind of program that's really more harmful and more damaging to our communities. So it's better for us to be at the table to sort of control and provide insight into what's going on in our own communities. So I think sort of across communities in the United States, people had different ideas for why they wanted to participate. They had different fears, different desires through collaborating on CVE projects.
And Nicole, you mentioned in your talk about how the Obama administration formally launched CVE, I think it was in 2015. How has this countering violent extremism program changed, if it has, under the Trump administration? And how have CVE practitioners understood and implemented those changes?
When Obama launched countering violent extremism in 2015, he promoted it as this liberal progressive alternative to conventional counterterrorism practices. And he also, you know, said, you know, we're interested in protecting the civil liberties and civil rights of Muslim communities. So it certainly had this liberal progressive bent to it. And you might remember in 2016, when Trump won the election, he started talking about rebranding CVE as countering violent Islam or countering violent radical Islam. The idea was to explicitly name Islam as a part of the terrorist problem in the United States, to make that central. So some understood what Trump desired to be a more honest branding of what Obama had begun. So some, you know, admitted, look, this has always been about targeting Muslims. And so rebranding countering violent extremism as countering violent Islam is just a more honest representation of what's going on. Other practitioners said, look, we're worried that Trump is going to double down on police-led anti-terrorism initiatives, essentially rolling back what Obama launched in 2015. So these practitioners understood Obama's domestic war on terror to be different than President Bush's. And so people feared that Trump would revert back to President Bush's emphasis on sort of covert surveillance, infiltrating Muslim communities, and things like that. So, you know, part of how practitioners responded was how they understood CVE to begin with. You know, others were really hopeful. They said that, you know, the rollout of CVE in their own communities had been really toxic and had, you know, created distrust and suspicion among their communities. And so they saw the Trump administration as a way to reset what was begun under the Obama administration. So some people were hopeful, some people were fearful as to what would happen. But what we've really seen play out over the last 4 years is really just a continuation of what Obama started, that there is this emphasis on Muslim communities. There's an emphasis on mobilizing mental health professionals and teachers to participate in the domestic war on terror. And there's this idea that young people, young Muslims in particular, are radicalizing and seeking to join terrorist groups. So although practitioners varied in their understandings of the changes between the Obama and Trump administration, in reality, there hasn't been that big of a shift under the different administrations.
Any sense, Nicole, of what the future of CVE looks like, whether there is a momentum for this to continue on the part of CVE administrators, or whether the tide seems to be turning or has been turning against it such that there might be a growing reluctance on the part of authorities to continue implementing it?
On a federal level, the government announced another set of what they're referring to as targeted violence and terrorism prevention grants that were supposed to be announced at the end of August. So the idea here was that there would be another infusion of federal funds to support local CVE programs. Since that hasn't been announced yet, there's some speculation that the Trump administration might be reconsidering its terrorism approach within the United States. the Biden-Harris campaign has come out and said, look, we want to reevaluate what's been going on under the Trump administration, but hasn't really directly addressed the fact that CVE came out of an Obama-Biden administration. And so it's not clear if under a Biden-Harris administration, if CVE would be given up or if it would be transferred from the Department of Homeland Security, for example, to the Health and Human Services sector, which folks have been arguing for as a way to rebrand CVE to amplify the role of mental health professionals in countering terrorism within the United States. So as of now, it's sort of unclear, but I think the idea is the United States is still committed to the domestic war on terror, and it's still committed to relying on teachers and other social service providers to interrupt the radicalization process. So I think no matter what administration there is and no matter what kind of pushback there is, there's still going to be this commitment to rolling out different types of CVE programs across the country.
That was Nicole Nguyen, again her last name is spelled Nguyen, talking about her book Suspect Communities, Anti-Muslim Racism and the Domestic War on Terror. Nicole is Associate Professor of Social Foundations of Education at the University of Illinois at Chicago. She's also the author of A Curriculum of Fear, Homeland Security in U.S. Public Schools. And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.